Welcome to Create Photography. This is Daniel. In today's episode, I will have a conversation with Nashville-based photographer Madison Thorne. Madison is focusing on portrait photography with a particular focus on music and musicians in live and studio settings. Her ongoing COVID-19-based photo series called High Risk Humans showcases a broad range of individuals falling under CDC's high risk category. We will discuss her work in Nashville as well as her project. Madison, welcome to Great Photography. I very much look forward to speaking with you today.
Well, thanks for having me, Daniel. I appreciate it.
So, Madison, you are based in Nashville. Is that correct?
That is correct. I've been here for about 4 years now.
So, it sounds like you haven't always lived in Nashville. So, did you grow up in Tennessee or did you grow up elsewhere?
I am born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. I lived there till I was 28, and then I moved to Nashville.
Tell me a little bit about the differences about between Nashville and St. Louis, and you know how the experience has been for you more recently and compared to when you grew up.
I love being from St. Louis. It's a diverse city. There's so much culture there. It's a music-based city as well. There's lots of art. It's wonderful, but it started turning into a flyover city. You know, I'm a music photographer,
right?
And bands began not stopping in St. Louis. They were hitting Kansas City or, you know, the next city over. So a friend of mine actually dared me to move to Nashville in 2018, and I couldn't think of any reason why I shouldn't. So Nashville is actually called Music City,
right?
And there's music everywhere here. Everyone's a musician. Your barista's a musician. Your bank teller is a musician. Everyone's a songwriter here. So as much art as there was in St. Louis, the city actually functions. Nashville actually functions on music.
Well, that's a great lead-in, and I wanted to ask you about, you know, assuming based on, you know, looking at your portfolio and you know, your Instagram and so forth, clearly music is a key focus of your work. And can you just tell me a little bit more about that? I mean, obviously you started, you know, doing that before you were in Nashville, the music city. So yeah, I'd be curious to learn more about that.
So I'm a third generation photographer. My mother was a photographer and my grandmother was a photographer. So the photography, I was born into it. There was no other choice when it came to being a photographer.
It's genetic.
Right? And we grew up in a musical household. So there's music everywhere. And I was either playing music or I was listening to music, and I just started taking my camera to shows, and it was really a natural thing for me to start photographing musicians and concerts and that whole realm of reality.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, maybe let's start at the beginning with regards to your photography. So obviously your mom was a photographer, so you're third generation, you mentioned, so I assume one of your grandparents as well.
Right.
So when did you, first of all, when did you start photography, and when did you maybe know that that's something you're going to also take on as a serious endeavor?
I got my first camera when I was 12 or 13. I just found the photo the other day. It was my birthday that year, and they gave me a Minolta film camera. And,
oh, that's cool.
Right, so that's where it started. And I guess I made the decision when I was in high school. I thought I might do some other outlets. The idea of becoming a photographer, it's daunting, or mm-hmm. anything in the artistic realm, because there's no guarantee of income or anything really. So right. it's quite the leap. And mm-hmm. I wasn't sure I was going to do it for a minute. And then I did. And I said, you know, if I'm broke for the rest of my life, that's okay. But I'm going to take pictures.
Right.
I'm going to make art in this way.
And when you, so you had your first camera when you were pretty young. And then did the camera kind of stay with you all that time? And what kind of photography did you do when you started out? And then how did it evolve?
Good question. I think when you're young, you're just trying to figure out what you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I did that for a very long time. I wasn't sure who I was, so I wasn't sure what kind of art I was making, but music always made sense. The music community in St. Louis was home for me, so I was taking pictures of family members, essentially people I loved and cared about, and mm-hmm. so the music made sense and that storytelling made sense to me.
Right. And so you mentioned you started with film back then. Did you transition to digital at some point, or
yes, when did that switch happen? Probably in college, I would think, or just after okay. college. I got my first digital camera and stuck with Canon up until, well, still with Canon.
Yep. So you still, are you ever going back? Are you still using film, or are you really mostly digital at this point?
I'm 100% digital. Film 100%. Is so daunting at this point. it's not only daunting, it's expensive, but yep. I have all the respect in the world for photographers who use film. It's such a beautiful medium.
So tell me, going back to that time when you were getting, you know, maybe still in high school, kind of thinking about, you know, pursuing this professionally. Did you then also study this in college, or were you, how did that continue for you, that journey?
I originally wanted to be a photojournalist. And okay. so I started community college with the intent of getting a photojournalism degree. And I am a terrible student. I am an awful student. I did my darndest, but failed college algebra about 3 times. And then finally said, I can't, I'm just burning money at this point. I can't, this is not helping anything. So mm-hmm. I dropped out and started doing freelance work.
Okay. So basically you dropped out and then right away started photographing and finding clients and so forth, or how did
I think I was doing work all through that time, but
okay.
when dropping out of college, I decided, you know, if I'm just gonna have to do this full time, I'm gonna have to make this work.
Yeah. And did you back then, did you already focus on music as mm-hmm. your main okay that, so you kind of knew that that's your path and that's what you're gonna focus on?
Yes, that's okay. kind of always been my focus, because that's who I'm around. That's who I yep. hang out with. Those are my friends. That's what I'm doing all yep. the time.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I didn't know that St. Louis is that big of a music city. I just was not aware of it. So that's great to hear. And tell me a little bit more about that. What kind of music is it? Is it comparable to Nashville, or is it very different, or what kind of styles? And
it's very different. The level, the caliber of musicians is similar between St. Louis and Nashville, but St. Louis has blues and jazz and Cajun, and it's really, really diverse. And mm-hmm. Nashville is a lot less diverse.
There's
plenty of singer-songwriters here, with lots of country and honky-tonks, and
yep.
which can be diverse in and of itself.
Right.
But,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you playing music yourself as well? Just curious.
Yeah, I'm actually, I am a musician. I studied percussion all the way through middle school, high school, into college and beyond. I enjoy playing bass and guitar and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, that's cool. So do you have still find time to do that, or?
Yes, I don't make any money at it, so I'm never on stage. But I have my bass and guitar next to my desk, and I'll pick it up in between edits and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So quick interlude, but you know, today is October 23rd, 2022 for our listeners, and so it seems like, so I live in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities, and things seem to be largely back to normal where I live. So I was just curious for you how it is for you, how, you know, obviously you lived in Nashville through the pandemic, which is probably not that fun, and I'm sure a lot of the venues were shut down and all that. So how are things back in Nashville right now?
Things are confusing in Nashville right now. Nashville is a blue dot in a red state. So there was a good portion of bars that didn't close in the pandemic. And all of this to say is that, you know, I still wear a mask indoors in some places, but it's not common. I'm kind of the lone masker usually.
The outlier.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But when you went to Nashville 4 years ago, which was presumably before the pandemic, right? So so then do you feel like it's overall back to where it was then, or not quite? Or is it still, do you still see a difference?
I think certainly there's a difference. The music industry in general, I think, is trying to figure out how to, it's not stabilized yet, still trying to figure out how to come back and make money at a time where money's difficult, and how to do things still, it still needs to be done safely.
Right.
So there's certainly a before pandemic and after pandemic, or, you know, where we are now.
Right. And so how has it been for you personally? I mean, obviously probably safe to say for most all of us, this was a huge, you know, disruption. And I can just assume, I assume that you were freelancing through that time. How did that affect you, the whole?
When everything shut down in Nashville, it was still a very confusing time. We didn't have a lot of information yet. But shortly thereafter, the CDC came out with the term high risk. And that was referring to those that would be most susceptible to COVID. It would mean that we were most likely to be killed if we contracted COVID. And the people in that category were those with underlying medical conditions and those over the age of 65. And I'm a type 1 diabetic, so I was in that category. And it scared the bejesus out of me. So I couldn't work. I wouldn't work. It wasn't safe for me to do much of anything. Not that there was a lot going on, but I was working in a kitchen in the before times, just as part-time. And I wouldn't go back into a kitchen. I wouldn't work on a line with other people, you know, a few feet apart from them.
Yep.
But thankfully I was able to get on unemployment. So there was that safety net, which I'm very thankful for. But there was nothing to do. There was nothing going on.
Do you kept photographing through that time?
No, I originally was not able to photograph. There was nothing going on. We all kind of just sat around in our pajamas, for starters. And, you know, even nature photography, which I don't usually dabble in, but I don't know about you, the sun didn't seem to shine as brightly.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't as inspiring as it might usually have been. But that all kind of changed when I started the high-risk human series. I began photographing almost constantly throughout the week.
Yeah, and let's talk. That's a great lead-in. And in fact, that was actually going to be my next question as well. I wanted to kind of really explore that a little bit with you. So you started this personal project called High Risk Humans, and it is an ongoing photo series. So we talked a little bit about, you know, what prompted you, but maybe let's talk a little bit more about how this is all started and what prompted you to kind of create that series.
Sure. Whenever I talk about the beginning of the photo series, I start with John Prine. John Prine was arguably the greatest songwriter of the past century, maybe other than Bob Dylan. But John Prine was a hero of mine, and he contracted COVID very early on, I think in late March of 2020. And he passed away on April 7th. And that wrecked me. I was so distraught over his passing. He was a hero of mine, and his music was the soundtrack of Nashville for me. And I start the story with this point because I thought at that time that would be the darkest part of the pandemic for me. And 2 weeks after John Prine passed, there were protests in downtown Nashville, just a few miles from where I live, where people were demanding the reopening of businesses. They had decided that the quarantine had gone on for too long and they were over it. And one of these protesters held a sign that said, "Sacrifice the weak." And that's referring to the high risk. It's referring to me. It's referring to people I love and care about. And that I already thought I was at my darkest point. And then that sign put me in bed for 3 days because a stranger had decided what my life was worth. And she said it was worth absolutely nothing. So on the third day, after not moving for 3 days, on the third day, I decided that I wanted to take pictures of the high risk so that when somebody said sacrifice the weak or something to that effect, I could show them pictures of who they were referring to. I wanted to humanize that statistic. And so I texted a few friends that were in the high risk category, and I said, I have no idea how this project is going to pan out, but can I take your picture? They said, of course, absolutely. And I started taking pictures, and they kind of naturally, interviews naturally happened as well. Folks were not only desperate to feel seen, they were desperate to feel heard as well. So I showed up with my camera and I took their portrait and I listened. And I did that for that entire summer and into the fall as well, pretty much till it started getting cold again.
And is it, and maybe I misinterpreted, but is it still an ongoing project or is it something you kind of wrapped up by now, the overall project?
If someone would like me to interview them and take their portrait as part of the series, I'd absolutely do it. It's not gone.
Right.
We've just kind of, we're trying to do our best to work around it.
Right. So I have a little bit of an understanding, and you discussed, you know, how it started, some of the motivation. So what is your goal with the project? I mean, now you have a already beautiful body of work, and we'll link to that in the show notes. Of course, there's a dedicated website, and it's on your website as well. But just kind of curious, what's your goal with the project? Perhaps personally, but also for the project itself.
Originally, when I started the project, I was still angry. I was still angry at the person who wrote the sign. It was dark and I was angry. And I originally thought that I wanted to speak to those that said sacrifice the weak. I wanted to be able to put these portraits in their face and say, this is who you're talking about. This is who you're willing to cast aside. And what I realized very quickly is that the project, the series, meant more to the high risk. It meant more to the people that were being cast aside because it made them, I've said this a few times, seen and heard, but that was such a difficult thing at that time during the quarantine because we couldn't connect with anybody. It was impossible to do so. It was not allowed to do so, kind of. I mean, unfortunately, when somebody says high risk, you think of a specific type of person that's maybe on the brink of death or something, you know, something very, very wrong with them. But you look at me and you can't see that I'm a type 1 diabetic. There's nothing on my physical appearance that would indicate that. And that's that the series ended up speaking to how much we don't know about our neighbors. We have no idea what they face. And the series ended up asking people to be empathetic to our neighbors and to those around us, just because we don't know.
Right. Yeah, no. And, you know, I'm personally not a high risk person. I lost family members to COVID, so I can, you know, obviously empathetic to that. But I do have to say, and, you know, as I said, we'll link to that in the show notes. I think it is a great way to, you know, I think how you portray the people that in your series, but then with their stories to kind of put that such a label into perspective. I thought that was actually really brilliant, really great to hear that, because as we discussed, right, these people are they're basically you and I. There's no distinction. It's just like kind of a label that that is probably not was kind of misinterpreted maybe, and also people obviously then it gets politicized and all that other stuff, right? That
absolutely, yeah. Going back to the original sign, the Sacrifice the Weak sign, my friend Anana, who is in the series, made the fantastic point that those being referred to the weakest are actually the strongest. You know, myself with an autoimmune disease, I have to fight a battle every single day just to exist. And that I'm strong because of that. I'm not weak. And so many people in that series are the same way. I mean, I spoke with cancer survivors, people who were having cancer treatments at the time, people with MS, with lupus, asthma, so many different conditions, but they were all incredibly strong and resilient because of it. So I wanted I ended up wanting to change the narrative that the weak, or that those in the high risk category were somehow weak, when in reality it was the exact opposite.
It's the opposite. Yeah. And maybe that leads into my next question a little bit, you know, with your, I mean, obviously you talk to a lot of people in that so-called high risk population, but then you are high risk yourself, as you mentioned, with your type 1 diabetes. And, can you tell me a little bit more about your personal experience during the pandemic? I know you mentioned, you know, obviously, you know, you didn't go back to your restaurant job and so forth in the kitchen. That was one obvious effect. But what were some of the other things you've experienced during that time?
I feel like the pandemic exposed the underbelly of society. you know, the people willing to say sacrifice the weak, the mm-hmm. people who are unempathetic. We just, they came to the forefront and they started shouting, and that was a difficult time to be high risk, because there was this large group of people that said I wasn't worth anything, and said I didn't contribute to society, said that my loss, a loss of my life wouldn't mean anything. So I was so gosh darn depressed during that period of time. It mm-hmm. was, it seemed to be a fight every single day. I mean, I already have a battle with, you know, my type 1, but mm-hmm. to try and exist on top of that, to have to stand up and say that I am worthy of existing every single day is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started the series, I suddenly had mission and purpose. And I think the series got me through the worst of the pandemic. I was able to, it allowed me to safely connect with people. Mm-hmm. I got to make friends and meet people, and I was able to rally folks, and I was able to create a pedestal, you know, for people to be able to stand on and share their story and platform. I didn't mm-hmm. want the word pedestal. I wanted the word platform. So was able to create, I was able to create a platform for the high risk to share their stories. And I was just listening to one of your past episodes, and his name was Linda. I can't remember her last name, but you were talking about the importance of having a project.
Mm-hmm.
And at a very basic level, the High Risk series gave me a project, and it gave me something to rally behind.
Mm-hmm.
It got me through the pandemic. It got me through a very dark, dark period of time.
Right. Did you, you know, I was curious. So, you know, the people in a demonstration, right, who put up a sign like that, you always wonder, right? My inclination would be to never engage with such a person, because I always think it's hard to cure ignorance.
yes.
But nor, you know, talk with ignorant people. But that said, right, some people also say, well, maybe it would be good to engage in conversations. And so I guess so my long-winded way of asking you the following question is was the previous. So anyway, did you have a chance to actually talk to people who were maybe on that more other extreme of the spectrum of, you know, how they view the value of life and so forth, or did you just really obviously engaged with the high risk population with your project, but yeah, just curious if there were chances that where you had that opportunity.
I really didn't cross paths with any of these folks, which I'm very thankful for. I don't know what I would have done or said other than, you know, maybe try to listen. I don't know. It's very empathetic way of thinking, but I mm-hmm. just tried to give them an ear for a minute and understand. But really, I only interacted with the high risk and those that loved them. I really thought that when I started posting these stories, and you know, the series made the news and it got printed in a couple of magazines and stuff like that, I really thought there would be people coming out of, you know, dark corners or something like that and saying, no, you guys are worthless, and this is terrible. But it didn't happen. And I really think it's mm-hmm. because it's hard to say these aren't people. Right. You know, you look at these photos and there's, you know, a little 8-year-old kid on a swing set, smiling, having a great time. Like, how, what kind of person would say that this child is not worthy of a decent life or an attempt at a decent life?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and speaking of that, maybe as you were engaging with with those with those humans in the project, how did you go about approaching them? How did you find them? How did you mentioned a little bit, you know, you had some friends that were in that population, but I'm just kind of curious how that overall process evolves, because, you know, sometimes it's hard to approach, especially strangers, right?
Yes, and especially during a pandemic. How are you?
Right, exactly. Especially during a pandemic. Yep.
It's the power of social media. In all honesty, I started out with just my personal page and found, I think, 9 people were originally, or is what I started the website with. So I did these 9 interviews, but I put the word out. I said, hey, if you're high risk, I'd like to talk to you. I'd like to take your picture. I'd like to listen and hear your story. And people came out of the woodworks because they weren't being listened to at all. Mm-hmm. And this was a way for them to express themselves and claim their worth. And so I didn't have to do a whole lot of work in finding people, was my point. But once the website got put together, there's a form on it. You know, you can go in there and fill it out, and then I'll get an email. And then I just, you know, started calling people back. It was, I was lining up. The first day of photos, I lined up 3 different interviews in an afternoon into an evening. And I got to the end of that day and I said, I cannot do 3.
Yeah.
That was way too much. I started doing, 2 a day. And I start, the first one would be at 4:00 because, you know, you start getting the decent lighting at that time.
Yep. Yep.
And then I scheduled the second one for, I think, starting at 6:30. So I gave the first person 2 hours and then some travel time. And then, you know, 6:30 to 8:30-ish would be the second person. That's how I spent the summer. It was stacked for a long time.
Yep. And obviously you got to hear a lot of stories and speaking of stories, so was it difficult to get the conversation started usually, or do you felt like that was usual
not
because of
all.
The theme? Not at all. Okay.
No, it's because I was high risk too.
Yep.
So we could just sit there and talk about what we were experiencing. You know, I wasn't somebody trying to understand what this person was going through. I was in the trenches with them. So we were talking about, you know, what it was like to sanitize groceries and, you know, how do we maintain relationships and friendships with people when we can't get anywhere near anybody? So I didn't have actual interview questions written out. We just had conversations. And like I said, I made... Yep. At least 2 hours. I set aside at least 2 hours for these talks with people because we covered all of the topics. Usually it wasn't just the pandemic. I tried to, you know, I tried to get their entire story.
Yep.
Who they were, the whole thing, not just in the pandemic, but outside of it.
Right. You know, that's maybe more technical question. Did you take notes or did you record
this?
Okay.
I have,
just curious.
I absolutely took notes. I ended up buying a little, you know, digital recorder at some point in time.
Okay.
But I have a couple notebooks where I scribbled so fast through the bulk of it, and my handwriting's, I thought my handwriting would get better, you know, as time went on. I think it got worse, actually.
Yeah.
But yes, I definitely took notes.
Okay.
And
oh, that's cool.
When you read the stories on the websites, they're not that long. They're obviously not 2-hour conversations.
Right. Right.
But what I did is I would go home and I would edit the photos, and then I would piece together our conversation, their story, yep. essentially.
So
I would, sorry?
Oh, I was sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but
you're fine.
I assume from memory and then in part from your notes.
Yes, or, mostly,
yeah, okay.
mostly from my notes. My memory is rather okay. tragic, but... So I would piece together these stories because we would talk about, like I said, we would talk about everything. Like, we would talk about our favorite, you know, recipes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. These were not incredibly direct conversations, but
right.
So I would piece together their story, and then I would send the person their edits, and I would send them their story. And I said, how does this sound? Is this what you're trying to say? And sometimes they would say, it's perfect, great, post it. And then sometimes they would say, no, let's try saying this, or will you add mm-hmm. this, or will you take out this? So
okay.
It was a combined effort.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's great. So basically they had, which was, sounds great, so they had obviously a final say before the story
yes.
got posted. Yep. Okay.
Absolutely. That was very important for me, because it was their story. It wasn't anybody else's
yep.
story. It was theirs.
Yep.
It was their words. And
mm-hmm.
It was important for me for them to get the absolute final say.
Yeah. So, speaking of technical questions, I want to throw in one from the photography side, and it's not that technical. It's really more about black and white versus color.
Mm-hmm.
So I noticed that, so your series is, I believe, in black. Yeah, I think it's all black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But then you photograph on your website, your portfolio clearly has both. And so I'm just curious what inspires you to choose one, let's call it, you know, technique, I guess, over mm-hmm. the other. Do you have some sort of like with the project, I assume he had some sort of a vision beforehand, right? But I'm, you know, overall, I'm just always curious.
I have loved black and white for a long time, probably since I first got that, that film camera we were talking about at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started introducing black and white to my concert photography and really, really dialing that in, I found out how poignant it could be. You know, concerts are usually this huge visual ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take a moment like that and you strip it of its color and you just make it black and white, you can make that moment more finite. I can make people focus even more intently on what I want them to focus on.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
But all this to say is that I've been doing black and white for a very, very long time, and I didn't even give it much thought as to whether or not the series would be in black and white. I just kind of did it. It was just an automatic.
Yep.
It was just an automatic thing.
Mm-hmm. You kind of knew that was the right thing, obviously, for this project.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Okay. And then is it presumably for your professional engagements? Obviously, sometimes it, of course, depends on the client as well, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, you mean like.
The choice, I guess. If you're, you know, sometimes it's right.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
Sometimes they want the color. If it's for a client, I'll give them the option. I'm not gonna I'm not just gonna turn everything to black and white and say, well, this is what you get. It's
right.
It's a little bit different. But when I am, you know, left to my own artistic discretion, I usually lean towards black and white.
You tend to. Okay. Okay. Cool. So I want to quickly go back to the project, High Risk Humans, and just, you mentioned a little bit that you received, you know, great responses. You did, there was some, you know, press, including, you know, magazine articles about the project. Have you received any other responses about this project? Maybe from, also from people who are not considered high risk. Just curious.
Yeah, I've had people reach out from all over the country. I think it made it, it definitely made it to the UK. The response was gratifying because it was a lot of emails from folks saying that they either high risk and stuck at home and were lonely and, like, you know, much like myself, times were very dark, or it was from family members of high risk or friends of high risk individuals that, you know, thank you. This is what I've been saying. Thank you for, you know, putting it into a nice series like this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's more digestible, I guess.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think it's, you know, when I looked at it, I guess, you know, it's not always true, right? With art and visual art, it's not always so easy to convey the message. And maybe with this project, what's really nice about it, well, first of all, it's all about, this is real life, right? This is not something subtle. And it's real, it's real people, real stories, right? That are, and maybe even taking a step further, right? There are things that are life and death as well, right?
Yeah,
so, I mean,
absolutely.
This is not, the high risk is, there's still, the high risk is still there. So it doesn't mean like it doesn't exist. It's just how they use the label. Yeah, no, I think it's a wonderful project. And so we'll definitely recommend it to our listeners as well. And I guess, on that note, what are the things, you know, as you now went through this, you know, as a high risk person yourself through the pandemic, you know, we may have other, you know, other pandemics, unfortunately, in the future, there's going to be other flu waves coming, right? I mean, it's just, unfortunately,
yeah.
I hate to say this, but,
yeah.
But so what are some of the things that maybe we can learn as a society, as people? And take away, you know, when this hopefully it won't happen again, but let's say it happens again. Are there things that you feel like maybe people might respond differently the next time? Or
oof, that's a fantastic question. I got caught up on thinking that, but there might be another one.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't mean it to scare you.
The sun is shining and there might be another pandemic. Thank you, Daniel.
Sorry, I didn't mean to be a downer.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
As far as what folks might learn from this series, you just said it. The high risk are high risk, whether there's a pandemic or not. I'm still a type 1 diabetic. Whether there's COVID or not, like, that doesn't change. And so largely I hope that people can choose to lead their actions with empathy. I hope that people can go to this website and see the smiling faces and, man, maybe I should consider these folks when you know, I go to the grocery store or something like that. Because it was never really just about us as a singular person. The pandemic affected us as a community, as a society. If it was, you know, ravaging one community, it affected everybody. I mean, that's the thing. Is we're not, as much as people tend to think they're the main character of the story, we are very much just a part of a community.
we're interconnected, right? We're not just individual dots.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of it, maybe more from a government perspective, what would you, is there anything you'd like to see the CDC or just the government in general, you know, change? How could, you know, in their approach? and I'm not talking about, you know, who's going to be the next president or anything like that. I'm really more curious about, you know, based on your experience, you know, would you like to see certain things being handled differently, I guess?
I'm having these flashbacks from like the very beginning of the pandemic, like all the way through the winter, like the whole thing. There was no, I don't know if there was ever a 100% right or wrong way to handle any of this. I mean, it was just such a cluster. Mm-hmm. As far as the government goes, my most heartbreaking point when it came to whether or not the CDC or the government was hands-on or off was after vaccines, and we realized that vaccines weren't going to stop transmission, right? Like it was still, the pandemic wasn't going anywhere. In Nashville, the city, they said to restaurants, to bars, to venues, they said it's your problem. They said whether or not people have masks, it's all on you guys. You figure it out. And that put so many businesses in a tough spot, because if they created a mask mandate to protect their customers, there was a portion of people that were going to be really pissed off about it, and they were going to lose money. And it was such a double-edged sword situation. And that, I don't know whether that really answered your question or not, but that was just a certain point in time that, that really pissed me off.
No. Yeah. I totally understand that. I guess even in the government's or the responsible people's defense, right? This was all new, and it was maybe all bigger than we all anticipated as well, or more extreme. I certainly underestimated how severe this will be.
Oh yeah. Remember when we thought it was just going to be a couple weeks?
Yeah.
Here we are two and a half years later.
Exactly. And anyway, so switching gears a little bit from the project into potentially other projects. So do you plan any other personal projects at the moment? Are you thinking about some other projects, or do you even have time for that?
That's a fantastic question. I just kind of realized the other day, I was like, you know what? I should probably get a project together. Right now, my work is all, it's still with musicians, so but it varies with whether or not it varies by what the project is. Just start this one over.
Yep.
so I'm still working with musicians, obviously, and it's either album artwork or recording studio sessions or concerts. It's all diverse, but it's all based around musicians. And so I don't know, that's a fantastic question. It's like, maybe I should have a little mission and purpose in my life again. I'm not entirely sure.
I didn't mean to imply that whatsoever. I was just curious if you had anything else in plan, or maybe you were planning, maybe this could become a book project, right? Your other project, the High Risk Humans project, right?
I would love for it to be a book project. I definitely see that happening in the future, but I also think that people don't want to talk about it right now. People are still very sick of it.
Right.
But it's, as far as like a book, it could definitely be a book, because it's not entirely pandemic based in the larger scheme of things. It's exactly. just about being empathetic towards the people around you. So if, I mean, this could be a teaching tool in many regards.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it will be, that's just my bias, but I think that will be a perfect book project. And it's, you know, it has a very great theme. And, you know, it has the people, it has the stories. It just has, yeah. And you're right. It doesn't need to even relate to COVID. I mean, that's just, it so happens it relates to it. But I agree. So speaking of projects, again, I just a question for you. So for photographers, you know, we have many other photographers listening to this podcast, and one or the other is interested in starting their own longer range personal project. And so I was just curious, you know, I know your project started out of a passion, that you had a very clear reason to start that, but nevertheless, I'm just curious if you had any advice to give for, you know, having a somewhat longer range project.
As far as extended projects for photographers, I would just ask what is already catching your eye.
Mm-hmm.
So mine was a passion project, like you said, but it quickly turned into something I was doing every day. And but I was just talking to Jim Harrington, who's based in Nashville, an incredible photographer, and he came out with the Climbers book a few years back. But all of this to say is that Harrington was, I believe, already just speaking with these climbers, he was already invested in this, in these stories, and just mm-hmm. decided to pursue it, I guess, and define the parameters of the series. Just mm-hmm. find what is already catching your eye and sparking your interest, and set the parameters and go with it.
Yeah, you raise a good point. So you're kind of saying also, you know, don't come up with some random whatever project that is not even may or may not even be within your interest. Just go with what's already naturally what you're naturally drawn to, right?
Right.
That makes a ton of sense. Yep.
That might be the safest bet, because you're already drawn to it, so you're probably going to continue being drawn to it. And the important thing about a project like that is, it more so than anything else, it has to pique the artist's interest.
Yep.
It has to keep you going. If you're not, if you don't care about the subjects, then what's the point? Nobody else is going to care.
Yeah, likely the photographs might not be that great then, and you're not caring anyway. So that's a good point. So Madison, before we wrap up, I have a couple more questions. We haven't talked a ton about your concert and studio or music photography, but I'd like to talk a little bit about that as well. So, you know, this is it's kind of a cool genre, obviously. I personally, you know, a lot of people love music. I love music. I'm a musician myself, actually, as well. But anyway, I guess what I'm curious about is, you know, for photographers who might be interested in going into that genre, what is some of the advice you can give? I mean, again, you know, we could argue, that just comes naturally to you. But, you know, there's certainly some things that I'm just curious, you know, you've been doing that for quite a long time now. And what advice would you give to somebody who wants to maybe get into this, and maybe even getting into this professionally?
Oof.
Another big question.
It's just multi-layered and spanning a decade or so of information. It's a great question. As far as getting a start into, let's say, concert photography, not just, you know, the vague music photography, concert photography.
Yep.
Concert photography is it's such a hodgepodge when it comes to your lighting and the movements, and it can be overwhelming if you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to start concert photography, start if you can, if possible, photograph a band you love. Photograph a band you like. And because I feel like if you love the band, that's going to translate into your work. It's going to be obvious that you like what they're doing.
Right.
Technical aspect, throw it on auto white balance. I don't care what anyone says. Those lights are changing every 15 yeah. seconds, if not yeah. quicker. Throw it on white balance, open up the aperture, and pray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And maybe on the technical side, what about on the business side of things? Because that's always, it seems to be, right? And I know that's a big question. That's a big question, but now you're obviously now living in, you know, you're living in the right place. I mean, you can mm-hmm. say that, I guess. But regardless, right? There's always, you got to find, if you want to do something professionally, obviously you have to find your clients eventually. And so, mm-hmm. and you know, now you're obviously more established, but you know, for somebody who maybe starts out, is there do you have any thoughts on that?
Okay, I suck at business. Let's get that out of the way. I'm terrible at business. But as far as finding clients, I just went to, this started back in St. Louis, I just went to the local music scene. If you can, get access to the musicians, get access to the people, start on the local level. Actually, that great goes back to the advice from a second ago. Start at the local level when it comes to photographing. Mm-hmm. And then build your client base that way. And then those local musicians likely know, the musicians that are a step above them, and you can move up to that level of clientele, and then you move up to the next level of clientele. You're not going to drop in and start shooting Jack White right off the bat. You're gonna have to work your way up, and it's going to take a minute. But when it comes to any advice whatsoever, just be kind. Mm-hmm. I've made some idiot business calls or decisions and stuff like that, but I was kind, mm-hmm. and so they were kind. You know, they're like, "Hey, you screwed this up." And I'm like, "Okay, I'm very sorry." And they're like, "Okay, cool, don't do it again." Okay, cool, great. So all this to say is that you, as long as you're calm, cool, collected, and kind, you can work your way up the ladder, and mm-hmm. People will be forgiving when you make mistakes. I accidentally formatted a memory card once, lost an entire session.
And, oh no!
Bad stuff. But yeah. They were good people, because if you just find good people. It's very this is a very roundabout answer to your question. Yeah. But
no, it's good, because you kind of. Maybe I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but so
please
first
paraphrase.
Of all, I'll paraphrase a little. So find your, again, go with what you like, go maybe with a band you like, as you said, go local initially, and start up, just start somewhere. Right. Mm-hmm. And then don't try to go like big right away, which is obviously usually doesn't work anyway. Right.
Sure.
Away.
Of course.
And so, yeah, no, I think that's great advice, and and be kind, be probably also paraphrasing, be authentic, right? Don't try to be somebody else, which I think in photography we all can fall into sometimes. But
sure.
That's great. And so, is your curious on your current work? So you said concert, obviously, and you know, I know there's studio work involved as well. What is your Maybe what's your mix right now of the different, when you look at kind of your assignments? And then, of course, I realize that changes probably all the time.
Great question. I do think it's a healthy mix between concert work, like studio sessions, like recording studio sessions, and portrait sessions. There might be a little more one week than the other or something like that, but there's a lot of musicians in this town that need a lot of different things. It keeps it interesting, which is nice.
And for your, and maybe that is a little bit more technical question. You know, obviously I understand for concerts, you just, it's the so-called available light, which tends to be whatever and ever changing. For studio, I guess you may have sometimes more control. Do you ever bring in extra lights when you do for your studio recording sessions, or do you have some sort of a process there, or
recording studio sessions are so difficult, or they can be because you very much have to not be there. You have to be a fly on the wall. You cannot
kind
make
of
noise.
Stay out of the way.
You absolutely cannot impose in any way. I have these two tiny little lights that are maybe 4 inches by 10 inches, something like that. Just little tiny LED panels. Mm-hmm. And I've taken them into the studio a couple times. Recording studios are actually largely dimly lit. Right. They want to keep everything, quiet and calm and in the right mindset for making good music. But I will take these tiny LEDs and I'll ask the musician, like, hey, do you mind if I just set this up for one take? And usually they're fine with it. And so I'll just turn on that guy and just give myself a little bit more lighting and then take it out after the one or two takes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about when you just do sessions with musicians for portraits? Do you then, is that kind of situational? I mean, do you often do available light, or do you bring some lights sometimes, or is it really a hodgepodge of things?
It's totally a hodgepodge and very much situational. It depends on what the client wants, I love using available lighting. And to me, as long as the space is interesting, you're going to come back with good stuff. I also don't know lighting very well. So, I mean, I can do the work I need to do, but as far as being creative with lighting, I am not at the caliber of some of the photographers around me. So I steer towards available lighting just because that's what I know.
That's what you're used to, and
right, but it also depends on the client. So if it's a singer-songwriter that would just like some very simple portraits, then that's what we do. But if it's a singer-songwriter that wants something crazy over the top for their next single, then that's what we do. Just kind of make it work.
So in your work, do you sometimes, like in commercial photography, right, sometimes photographers work with, obviously bigger companies, and, there might be art directors involved and, other creatives and this and that, and so producers. And how is it when, in your work, do you kind of have those similar interactions sometimes, or is it often more direct with the musicians?
I am fortunate in that I have built a clientele and relationship with the musicians. So it's more often than not, I speak with the musicians are the ones that bring me in to the situation.
Got it.
The it's the band that says, hey, we like your stuff. Come photograph us. Mm-hmm. Sometimes labels will reach out. Sometimes managers will reach out. But I don't, Nashville, with it being Nashville, I am fortunate enough to be able to, like I said, build these relationships and kind of cut past the red tape, the bureaucracy that keeps a lot of people out.
Got it. All right. Well, good. Well, to wrap up my final question, hopefully that's an easy one, is basically where can people best find you and your work?
Yes, that's a pretty straightforward one. I can take that one. It's not really technical at all. So the High Risk Human series, you can find that at highriskhumans.com. That is also on Facebook and Instagram as well. As far as my work and my personal work, there's just my website, madisonthorne.com, and the Instagram page, which is just mthornphotos, I believe.
mthornphotos. Okay, cool. And we'll link to that in the show notes as well.
Yay!
Awesome. Well, Madison, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was really a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.
All right, this wraps up my conversation with Madison Thorne, Nashville-based photographer. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find examples of her work as well as the links to her websites at danielsikphotography.com/episode075. So yes, this is the 75th episode, so this is very exciting. We're approaching 100, but that will probably take a little while. And as always, if you want to support the podcast, please do so at buymeacoffee.com/Daniel Sick. I also appreciate everybody who has donated to this cause thus far. All the proceeds will go directly towards the production costs of this podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and talk to you next time.